This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Is really the fruit of my Shabbos afternoon spent in my study. And I usually leave myself in the hands of the Ribbono Shel Olam quite heavily, and it usually works. But in any event, both the content of the shiur and the atmosphere of the shiur is all something which starts cooking quite early on the Shabbos. Tonight, I won't even call it a shiur, because I didn't sit and learn in the normal formal way this afternoon in my study. I rather sat in an easy chair and let my mind wander. And you'll see at the end of the shiur what the starting point of my wandering was. And I'm going to wander over things that we've said before. I'm going to wander over things which I think that nearly all of you know. I'm going to wander over them firstly because to an extent we all know these things, but they apply to us still. To an extent some people don't yet know these things. And also, they're important to know in relationship to other people too. I don't think anybody has really understood or grasped the purpose of my present series of shiurim, the common denominator that's run through the shiurim over the last 2-3 weeks, all of them, not just the Motzei Shabbos shiur. But basically, what the theme has been is one of reinforcing a system of Yiddishkeit which is no longer popular. We're living in a world, as we discussed during the Shalosh Shiurim, of mass reaction. It is surprising to what extent even intelligent people's reactions to circumstances are influenced today by mass reactions. Television, press, publicity, the desire to be accepted and to be part of a group. There are many reasons for it. We've talked recently about the value of popularity in modern Western society. It's a value which takes much more precedence than it ever has before. The need to be accepted, the need to be popular, is a very strong need today, more so than it's ever been before. And all this encourages mass reaction, doing things without really thinking them out carefully. Lithuanian Yiddishkeit, from which we all stem, was never a Yiddishkeit for the masses, which was one of the criticisms against it. It provided for the masses, but never by reducing the Yiddishkeit, never by reducing the Torah to the level of the masses. Always by insisting that the masses had to strive up as high as they could, stretch themselves to reach the levels of Torah. We've discussed various aspects of the Lithuanian system. The method that they used for ensuring that the man in the streets had a place within Yiddishkeit. Be that as it may, it was never a Yiddishkeit for the masses, and after the Second World War, how much more so was it not a Yiddishkeit for the masses, because there were so few proponents of Lithuanian Yiddishkeit left to the world. Virtually all the other styles of Yiddishkeit are styles developed for and well suited to the masses, which is nothing against them, on the contrary. What they achieved in the areas in which they operated and among the people that they operated could never have been achieved by Lithuanian Yiddishkeit. And even today, what certain popular styles of Yiddishkeit is able to achieve cannot be achieved by traditional Lithuanian Yiddishkeit. However, one has to be careful to see things in their correct perspective, and most important of all, one must not become apologetic about one's own style of Yiddishkeit. And one can only relate fruitfully to other styles of Yiddishkeit if one understands one's own properly. We were talking at the Shalashudas about the tragedy of the modern practice of religious Yiddishkeit, which is a simple mishmash. It's a couple of pounds of Hungarian with a few ounces of Polish, and another couple of kilos of Lithuanian with a few pounds of Hasidish, all mixed up to make a cake which nobody's ever seen before. It's not a style of Yiddishkeit which was ever known before. Modern religious Yiddishkeit, as we see it today, is not something which has its origins with our fathers, our grandfathers, our great-grandfathers, or anybody's great-grandfathers for that matter. This is a new creation. There can be richness in mixtures, providing the ingredients remain separate. When the ingredients are mixed up together, you've got a mess. As long as each one understands himself well, he can relate constructively to somebody else. If he understands, if he has security in the knowledge of his own system, if he knows how it operates, and he knows why he's chosen it and why it's suited to him personally, he can respect others and he can relate positively to others. But until he has a system which he understands clearly and which he relates to properly, he can't do so. And the theme over the past couple of weeks has been explaining certain aspects of Lithuanian Yiddishkeit and how they're meant to operate. Lithuanian Yiddishkeit doesn't have to import Hasidic emotion. Of course there's such a thing as Hasidic emotion. Of course it's strong emotion, and it's positive emotion. But it's different to Lithuanian emotion. And to follow a Lithuanian system of learning with a Hasidic system of emotion, you get a mixture which is neither Hasidic nor Lithuanian. There has to be a certain consistency, and one has to understand how, according to the Lithuanian shita, to the Lithuanian system, one reaches that emotion, those peaks of emotion and that strength of emotion which one needs to be a spiritual human being. But tonight I'm not going to talk about Lithuanian versus Hasidish. I'm going to talk about a particular aspect of a danger that I've seen in modern Frum Yiddishkeit, particularly among people who've come into it from scratch. The danger is distortion or disproportion in one of the most important ingredients of Yiddishkeit. That is Yiro. Yiro commonly translated as fear. But I think we know already what Yiro means in the superficial sense. As I was preparing the shiur, I ran through the various Talmidim of the Beis HaMedrash, and I found that without exception, including myself, all of us, there's either a distortion or a disproportion of Yiro. Some of us have got, nobody's got too much Yiro, as we'll see at the end of it. There's no such thing as too much Yiro. But some of them have got the wrong kind of Yiro. Some have got too little Yiro. This is an area of disproportion or distortion which needs to be corrected. What is Yiro? The purpose of the shiur is not to discuss what Yiro is really, it's to discuss what Yiro isn't. But before we get to that, just very briefly, Yiro, as we've discussed many times, is from the word ro'eh, to see. Yiro is perception, it's not fear. Yiro is simply seeing things as they really are. If one sees an ant as it really is, one has Yiro for the ant. If you look at an ant not as it appears on the surface, but you look at an ant in terms of what makes it work, how it functions, how it's different from other animals, how it's created to operate specifically in its environment and to perform its task, how it operates within a community, how its whole community operates, its lifespan, how it operates within that lifespan, its relationship to other insects and animals, then you'll have Yiro. Yiro is simply to see things as they really are, and the consequence of seeing things as they really are is the emotion of awe. But you can't reach awe without Yiro, without perceiving, looking at the thing in its essence, what it really is. The with another emotion, which we call Ema. Ema is an extension of Yira, or a subsection of Yira. Ema is understanding the consequence of things. Yira is understanding the essence of the thing, to perceive it correctly. Ema is to understand the consequence of the thing. Why do we need all this? You know, there is a strange human tendency to go and see horror movies. Now, try and work it out. What is it? What makes a person want to go and see a horror movie? But it starts very soon, because one of the ways to make a very small child giggle and laugh, with tremendous laughter in fact, is to give it a fright. And after the child has recovered from the fright, the reaction is one of laughter. And if you watch most mothers and fathers playing with their kids, that's what they're doing. They're terrorizing the poor children. The children love it. So there is something very basic that drives an individual, or drives a human being, to search for terror. What is it? It's adrenaline, that's all. When you're scared, you're alive. Or shall we say, even more so, the moment of being saved from the terror is the moment you really feel alive. Having come through it, now you're still here, that means you're living. Then it's forgotten and the adrenaline goes down. What the child laughs at is not the terror. The child doesn't laugh while it's scared, but the moment the terror's gone, the tension is released in laughter. And the feeling of a horror movie, why we can't understand the emotion that drives a person to see a horror movie, is because you try and think, what can he be enjoying watching it? He doesn't enjoy anything watching it. He enjoys getting out. It's coming out and feeling alive and looking at the world still the same as it was before that makes him realize that the world isn't such a boring place after all. And we go on ghost trains and we do all sorts of things to scare ourselves. What is it? It's a level of adrenaline that makes us feel alive. Because mostly our lives are boring and empty. And a bit of terror, after the terror you feel you're really living. Excitement is very close. The boundary line between terrorism and in this sense, and excitement is very narrow. To go on to a very dangerous mountain climb, not talking about a challenging one, a very dangerous one, to look for all these daring, dangerous sports, this is all very close to the same drive that causes one to go to a terror movie. You want to scare yourself. Or more important, you want the feeling that of coming out alive after having been scared. That's the excitement and the exhilaration of a dangerous sport. And without Yira and Ema, Yiddishkeit can be boring. Ema is similar to the word la'ayem. The verb of Ema is la'ayem. La'ayem means to threaten. And one of the cases where we use it is in there's a Mishnah in the fourth parak of Sanhedrin where the Mishnah says, Ketzad ma'ayamim es al ha'edim. How do you threaten witnesses when they come to court, when an aide comes to court? How do you threaten him? And the Mishnah describes the process where you call him and you tell him about the terrible consequences of telling a lie and how much depends on what he's going to say, and it's life and death, and how serious murder is. And murder doesn't mean just killing somebody, but being the cause of somebody dying, even indirectly, and so on and so forth. You put the fear of heaven into him. You're terrifying him, terrorizing him in a sense. Except it's with truth. You're not telling him anything that's untrue. You're simply describing to him the true and real consequences of what he's about to do. And you're showing him, don't think that it's just an irrelevant little thing that you're coming to tell us a story and we'll make up our own mind in any case. Understand to what extent the whole thing now revolves around your words. Choose your words carefully, because you must understand the consequence of your words. Ema is to understand the consequence of what we're doing. Every little movement of ours has vast consequence. Every word we say is going to influence events. Every action we make is going to influence events. How much more so, every decision we take, even seemingly inconsequential decisions, are going to be important. If you choose to go to work using the M1 or using Leboeuf Avenue, it might make little difference except the time you get to work. Not so. You might see things on the one that you don't see on the other. And what you see on the one can influence you, it can give you a thought which you wouldn't have had on the other. And that thought can lead to a new understanding of something you wouldn't have thought. It could be a positive thought, it could be a negative thought. It could be a new understanding which leads you to new heights and to new decisions, which you would have missed had you taken the other road. Every little decision has consequences. Every decision leads to other decisions, and every choice one makes opens the possibilities to other choices. One has to understand that nothing one does is without consequence. Nothing one does is irrelevant. A lady can be standing in the kitchen mixing the dough. That's not unimportant. That's important. It's going to affect somebody. It's going to be consumed by somebody. It's going to become part of somebody's body. And not just as it must be physically healthy, it must be spiritually healthy. Certain thoughts go into the making of that cake or the making of that bread or whatever it is that she's making. Certain intentions, certain feelings. And it's not, as well as the dough in the physical sense, also those feelings, those thoughts, that spirituality is all going to be consumed by an individual or by several individuals. And it's going to affect them. A woman has to understand when she's mixing the dough that she's not just mixing the dough, she's doing something important. And a man must know if his work is cleaning the streets, that's important. There's consequence. If he leaves a banana peel lying around instead of sweeping it, somebody might die. It's important. It has consequence. That's Amar. Amar is simply understanding the consequence of one's events, of one's actions. All of events in general. Yira and Amar are both genuine, bona fide Torah experiences, which one needs for growth. Without Yira and Amar, there's no adrenaline, there's no spirituality. Life becomes a bore, it becomes a routine, it has no excitement to it, whatever, and where there's no excitement, there cannot be any growth. And where there's no growth, there's no spirituality. But there's another emotion. Sorry, before we go on, Amar and Yira, in fact, are listed in the sixth parak of Pirkei Avos as two of the 48 kinyonim of Torah. It's two of the ingredients one needs to learn Torah. Without Amar and Yira, you can't learn. Now, it's a little bit like the example that I gave some time ago about playing roulette without real money. Right, that's an action without consequence. That's an action without aimer. Playing with real money, that's the aimer. And the more money you put on, the higher goes the adrenaline. And the more consequence there is in your action. There's another emotion. And that is the emotion of pachad, which means fear. Now, pachad is a different emotion altogether. What is pachad? Rashi defines pachad in Gittin Daf Ayin, 70a. Da'aga she'do'eg al davar ha'atid. A worry that a man has on something in the future. Kegon, for example, tirud mazoinos o pachad oyev. The worry about a parnosa, about one's income, or fear of an enemy. That's pachad. The difference between pachad and yira is that pachad has got nothing to do with perception. You're worried about something in the future which you can't even see. This is fear of the unknown. That's what pachad is. In fact, in Iyov, for those who like horror stories, there's a little piece which is fantastically dramatic. Ve'elai davar yugunav. This is in the fourth chapter of Iyov. And to me, a thought was stolen, so to say. I grasped the thought, and my ear took hold of it. It came from thoughts that come from the visions of night. When sleep befalls people, when people start falling asleep. All of a sudden, pachad, a fear, took hold of me and trembling. The roivats masai hivchid, and most of my bones were actually trembling. The ruach al panaya chalof, and a breeze started blowing over my face. Tisamer sa'arat besari, the hair on my skin stood up. Yamud, it stopped. The loy akir marehu, and I couldn't see its form. Tmunol leneged einoi, there was a form in front of my eyes, but I couldn't see what it was. The mama, there was silence. Vakol eshma. And then I heard its voice. And it goes on. But you see here again, the pachad, the fear, is out of what? Out of lo akir mareyu, I can't see what it is. There's something in my room, there's something that's come, and I can see vaguely the form, but I don't know what it is. There's pachad, that's fear. Fear is something one has of the unknown. Fear is in fact the opposite of yira. Yira comes from perception. The more you understand it and the more you perceive it, the greater the yira. Pachad is something else. Pachad comes from inability to perceive, from vagueness, from lack of clarity, from blackness, darkness. But pachad also builds up the adrenaline. You can be lying in your bed at night and you wake up and you wonder what it is that wakes you up, and you think that it was a noise in the house. And you listen and it's silent, so you think it was obviously your imagination. And you're just trying to fall back asleep, and all of a sudden you hear it again. There is something. And you think, oh, it must just be something outside, and you lie down again, and you listen again, and it's not outside, it's inside. And then your heart starts beating. And then the adrenaline starts going up. Why? Because you don't know what it is. Not because you know what it is. If you knew it was an armed burglar, your adrenaline wouldn't be so high. You would decide what to do, you would make your decisions. Yes, the adrenaline would function, but there wouldn't be this pacha, there wouldn't be this fear. You don't know what it is. Do you get up and look? Do you stay where you are? You just don't know how to handle it. You can't handle it because you don't know what it is. That's pacha. It's exciting. But pacha, I gave another example very recently. The example of a mile-long path, very, very narrow, about 3-4 inches wide. And on each side of the path, a little bit more than 4 inches, maybe 6 inches, 7 inches, on each side of the path there is vicious barbed wire for a mile. And you're taken and you're told you've got to walk from one end to the other. And you stop. And you walk sideways just so that you can fit in between the barbed wire. And you realize that you're just making it. Where two barbs come together, in other words, where two barbs are exactly opposite one another, on both sides of the fence, it just touches you, but you can get through. Where there's only one barb on the one side of the fence, you can get through with a few millimeters to spare. And you start your walk. And this is a mile. And to walk a mile at the best of times is not that easy, it's a long walk. But to walk a mile step by step when you're watching every pace, that's already a bit of a nightmare. And to walk a mile pace by pace when one wrong step and you're torn to shreds, that's a big nightmare. And you walk and you walk, and you're just making it and you're about to come to the end, you can see the end, and you walk still further and you start walking a little bit faster, but you're still careful, and you get to the other end and you're through, unscathed. Right? You take out your handkerchief and you wipe your brow. And that's the terror movie. You've come out unscathed and you feel good. But you don't even look back. You just go. And you can have exactly the same situation with the same mile-long path, also 7 inches wide, but instead of barbed wire, on each side of the path you've got thousands and thousands and thousands of the most beautiful flowers planted. Each one carefully planted in a specific place to create specific patterns. And it's all set up there for a specific exhibition which is going to take place later that same day. And you've got to walk through this path. And you know one wrong step and there's going to be an ugly footprint in the middle of these flowers which is going to ruin the whole thing. And you walk step by step, carefully, one foot after the other. And somehow the mile doesn't seem quite as long as the first one. And you're not in quite of a cold sweat as you were the first time. And what do you do when you get to the other end? You don't just walk on. You stop and you look back. And it's a nice feeling. The adrenaline is also high. The only difference is that the first time you walked on and this time you stopped and you look back. Why? The first one you were threatened. And you got away without being hurt. That's all that matters. In the second one the flowers were threatened. You were threatened. And you got away without hurting them. And you look back with love. Pachad is inward. Pachad is when you're afraid that you are going to be hurt. That's what fear is. Yira is not inward. Yira is outward. Amazement and awe at something outside of yourself. You're not aware of yourself at all in half. When you're walking along this path with the barbed wire, you're very aware of yourself. You don't care anything about the barbed wire. All you're worried about is that you don't get hurt. And that's hard. When you've walked through the field of flowers, you haven't worried about yourself at all because you couldn't get hurt. There's been yiro, you've been aware of the importance of the flowers, you've been sensitive to not touching them, but you come out feeling a sense of achievement. It's been an outward emotion. So much so is this the case that the Gemara says in Brochus, sorry, can you just pass me the Brochus? It's probably the very first one there. No, Gemara. Brochus Daf Samach, that's 60a. How Talmid the Havaka Azil Basred Rabbi Yishmael Rabbi Yosi Beshukat Tzion. There was this Talmid that was walking behind Rabbi Yishmael Rabbi Yosi in the marketplace of Tzion. Chazye the Kol Mafchid. Rabbi Yishmael saw that this Talmid was afraid. Omale, what do you think he said to him? My son, what are you worried about? What's bothering you? No. Chator as you're a sinner. Because only sinners are scared. Tichtiv pachadu betziyon chatoyin. Because it says in Yeshayahu, come and be afraid in Tzion, O you sinners. So there's no reason for anybody else to be afraid. Amalei, so the student said to him, Vakativ, Ashrei Odom Mefachet Tomi, doesn't it say in Mishle, happy is the man who's always scared? Amalei, he answered him, Hal bedivrei Torah kasiv. That's only written about one's learner. Explains Rashi, the only fear one's permitted to have is the fear of forgetting something one knows. But there's nothing else one's allowed to be scared of. And if one is scared, chatorat. So I ask you firstly, how did he know that he wasn't scared of Divrei Torah? He saw that he was scared. How did he know he was scared? And secondly, how did he know that what was scaring him was not the fear of losing his knowledge or forgetting what he knew? That Rabbi Yishmael felt confident enough of calling him a sinner? It's very simple. If you're scared of forgetting your Torah, you're not walking around in the Shuk of Tzion. If you're scared of forgetting your Torah, you're revising it. You're working on it. He saw a man that was inwardly scared and trembling and looked as if everything was threatening him. He could see in his demeanor, in his bearing, that this was a scared man. And here we come to the point that I was talking about of what I'm concerned of. We talked last night about the fact that the world is a dark place. What do I mean by a dark place? One doesn't see things as they really are. We talked about seeing an ant. And so you can go through everything one looks at. There's seeing and there's perceiving. We see everything, those of us who are very observant. You're called observant, the world calls you observant if you notice everything. But to perceive, that nobody even expects from us. There's too much confusion. We're too interested ourselves. We're too involved ourselves to really perceive, to really see things the way they are. We're too interested in how we see them, not in how they really are. So the best we can be is observant, but not perceptive. And Torah is the light of the world, which we'll discuss a little bit further, because through analyzing something in a Torah fashion, one is able to see things clearly. One is able to see things as they really are. Pachat, fear. What does one do if one is scared? One's scared of death. I think I've told you, Reb Chaim Brisker used to have one phobia, and that was death. He was scared of death. And every now and then this fear used to come over him, and he used to get terribly depressed and miserable. What did he used to do when it happened? He used to take out his Rambam and his Gemaras, and he used to learn the dinim of tumah, the dinim of the of tumah as it is affected by a dead body, the dinim of kavura, of burial, the dinim of avelus. He would sit and immerse himself into these dinim until he mastered them thoroughly. What he was doing there, explains J.B. Soloveitchik, is the process of objectification. Taking something which is scaring you. Why does something scare you? Because you are being manipulated by it and you don't understand it. It is controlling you. Your body is reacting to it. There's a noise in your house and your adrenaline goes up. You're woken up. Your adrenaline goes up. You did nothing. You're not dictating events. There's someone outside your room there that's controlling you. He woke you up.
He's caused your adrenaline to go up. He's going to make you decide whether you get up or you don't get up, and what you're going to do and what you're not going to do, and you don't know how to handle him. The moment you can overpower him, the moment you can control him, the fear goes, no problem. You can still be in battle with him, but as soon as you're winning, as soon as you've pinned him down to the ground, even if he's still got the gun in his hand, the feeling of fear goes, because I can handle him. I now know what he is and who he is and how strong he is. I know his weak points and I can master him. Rav Chaim Brisker. And he would haul it into his Beis HaMedrash and he would analyze it. Just take it to pieces. What is it really? And that really is the whole mechanism, the activity of a Beis HaMedrash. In our Beis HaMedrash, we're just learning how to do it. But in a real Beis HaMedrash, they actually do it. It's taking something which looks big and terrifying and analyzing it. Just taking it to pieces. Let's see what it's really made up of. Let's see what its components are. Where does it come from? What is its purpose? Where is it going to? And so Reb Chaim Brisker used to take its phobia into his Beis HaMedrash and he used to analyze it for what it really is, objectively from a distance, academically. And having analyzed it, he was able to master it. And he could be creative in it. He could be mechadesh. He could come up with a creative thought in the concept of death. And then he was the balabos, and the fear used to disappear. And Lahavdil, Stefan Zweig says, Tolstoy used to do exactly the same. He had the same phobia. He used to be afraid of death as well, and he used to write novels about it. That was the way he mastered it. He felt that he was the balabos, not death being the balabos. So when one comes across something that one's afraid of, one has to take it, and one has to analyze it, one has to pull it to pieces, and see what it is after all. It's not that much, and it's not that difficult. In this dark world in which we find ourselves, the fears and phobias are tremendous. I mean, psychologists would have nothing to do if the light was on. And really, all one has to do to put the psychologists out of work, for oneself at least, if one doesn't want to bother about other people, is turn the lights on. Because once you can see what's doing the phobias go, I'm not talking about somebody who's clinically ill, but somebody who has a phobia, which is the problem with most psychological cases, it's simply because of the darkness. And sure, you have phobias in the darkness. Now, there are three ways of how to handle this darkness. The one way is get drunk. That's it. You're scared in the dark, just get drunk and forget that you're in the dark and forget that you're scared and forget that you're anything. That's one way. I don't mean physically drunk, one can get spiritually drunk as well. Just get yourself onto an emotional high and forget about the rest. It doesn't matter. It's all alright. Everything will be okay. One day Mashiach will come and it will all be over. Just have to survive, that's all. The other way is analyze it. Turn on the light. What are you scared of? Let's see what's really happening. Let's see what it really is. The third way is fear. Operate in fear. Just be scared. Don't move, because if you move, you're going to hurt yourself. Only move where I tell you you can go. Terrorism of a sort.
All three of those methods create spiritual delight. All of them create spiritual feelings.
Getting drunk spiritually, getting oneself onto an emotional high, one feels spiritual. Learning, analyzing, understanding, one feels spiritual. Fear, one also feels spiritual. One feels alive, one feels it's for real.
What I find worrying is the following. Take a person in his 20s, 30s, teens, it makes no difference, who decides to get involved in Yiddishkeit.
Ask yourself, after a period of a year of involvement in Yiddishkeit or 2 years of involvement in Yiddishkeit, have you learnt more don'ts or more do's? Have you learnt more what not to do or more what to do? Ask yourself. All of a sudden, Shabbos. What is Shabbos? One mass of don'ts. It's a day like all the other days, except you can't do all the things you used to do, you can no longer do. Okay, you must make Kiddush, and you go to shul and you hear Kriyas HaTorah. So you've got two do's, maybe Havdalah you'll count in as well, three do's, against not 49 don'ts, or 39 don'ts, against hundreds of don'ts. That's your Shabbos. What else did you used to get fun out of? Eating. Don't. You can't go to the places you used to. You can't eat the things you used to. Can't. What? Yes? brochas. Say a brocha before you eat. So it's one yes against all the things that are cut out. And just look at it, it's really unfair. Just look at the chances of a person coming out normal after he gets involved in Yiddishkeit. They're against him. What else did you used to get fun out of? Going to discotheques, Motzei Shabbos. Okay, so Shabbos is a write-off. Motzei Shabbos, at least you can make Havdalah and you can breathe a sigh of relief. You can get back into life again. Discotheques, out. Dancing, out. Movies, be very selective. That's not really the place to spend the Motzei Shabbos. Look, there goes your Motzei Shabbos. What do you do on Sunday? Oh, you read, but be careful what you read. The Sunday newspapers are not the kind of thing for a Jewish person to read. Most books and novels that are published today are not the kind of thing for Jewish people to read. Be selective, be careful. So what do you do? Just weigh up the do's against the don'ts, and you find that Yiddishkeit becomes, particularly for a person who's recently brought into it, one huge list of don'ts with a few do's. It's the barbed wire. He's given a long road with barbed wire on both sides. Just don't hurt yourself. He's shoved into a situation of pachad. He starts operating out of fear. My whole Yiddishkeit is, oi, am I allowed to do that, aren't I? May I, may I not? Oi, 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 what do you do? How do you do this? What next? Have I done it right? His whole Yiddishkeit starts becoming one of being terrified. And you know what's the weirdest part of it all? They enjoy it. It's the ghost train. It's fun. You feel spiritual. That becomes a spirituality. Chas v'shalom. And that's what I'm worried about. That Yiddishkeit is becoming a trip on a ghost train. It's becoming a horror story. It's becoming unpleasant. And if only people took it as being unpleasant, it would be half the problem. It's becoming unpleasant. And in our sickness, we're taking masochistic pleasure in all that unpleasantness. And we're afraid to say it's unpleasant. Because if we'll be told it's unpleasant, we'll say, that's your Yetzer Hara. That shows that you're not about Tshuva yet. You still like your old way. You don't understand. You're not into it yet if you find it unpleasant. That's what we're told. That's the terrorism. It's sick. It's absolutely sick. Now, this system of fear works on two types of people. It can work on a very healthy, primitive farmer. Guys, you know, farmers are very healthy people. They're down to earth. No hang-ups, no fears, no phobias, good yetzer tovs, good yetzer horrors, and you can terrorize them and there's no problem. It doesn't make them sick, they can take it. I was a rabbi in Stellenbosch, I know. It works. It makes them better people. Or you can do it on a person who's a tzaddik. A person who really is doing good and doing good and doing good, and you tell him, you put a bit of fear into him, okay, it won't make him sick. I don't see any reason to do it, but it won't make him sick. But most of us are people who are craving for something meaningful to do, not to do. Most of us have come into Yiddishkeit because we want a more meaningful life, we want more positivism to do. And what do we get? A whole lot of negativism, which we're told take as positivism. That's the real positive stuff. And if you don't see it as such, there's something wrong with you, you haven't made it yet. It's sick. It's absolutely sick. It's pachad. Instead of Yiro and Ema. Yiro and Ema are forgotten about, and this is Pachad. I'm now referring really to two systems. I'm not referring to the Hasidic system at all, which is the one of reaching an emotional high. Here we're really referring to the Hungarian system vis-a-vis a more Lithuanian system. And again, a Hungarian system designed in the areas of Hungarian Jewish population was successful, and bear in mind, among the Hungarian community there were tremendous Gedolim and Talmidei Chachomim, but they didn't follow the Hungarian system. The great people of all, take the Hasidim and any branch of Hasidim, take the Misnagdim, take the Hungarians, the Polish, the Czechoslovakians, take the Gedolim of all of them, some Sofer from the Hungarians, the Rabbeim from the Hasidim, some of the Gedolim from the Lithuanians, it's all the same stuff. You can read anything they wrote, it's the same style. You can see their method of operation, it's the same. The only machlokes, the only division, is how do you convey it to the people at the bottom? That's all. As far as they themselves, as far as becoming great is concerned, and being great, there was unanimity. You can discuss, even today, You can take a shaila and you can discuss it, a major problem, and discuss it with leaders of all these different systems, and you'll get the same kind of approach to it. But if you go to people lower down the rung, you'll get completely different systems. Because each person is trying, each group is trying to find the way of being able to bring people up from down below to levels of greatness. And there you have differences of systems and differences of methods. And these are the different methods we're talking about. And what I'm disturbed about here is the tendency for Yiro and Emo to be replaced by Pachad. Of course there's such a thing as Yiro. And of course there are more mitzvahs loy ta'aseh than mitzvahs aseh. There are more negative mitzvahs than positive mitzvahs. But we're told that all the negative mitzvahs are Yiro. They're all branches of Yiro. What does that mean? I can prevent a child from sticking his finger in the plug because I told him so. That's pachat. I can prevent him from doing it by teaching him what electricity is. Now there might be an age where the child is not sophisticated enough for yira, and so you use pachat. That's like we said with a farmer. There's a time, there is a level of sophistication for which pachat works. But the child has to grow out of that after a while. And as soon as the child is able to understand a little bit about it, what heat is, what pain is, how heat causes pain, heat, energy, electricity, it's all the same kind of thing. A bit of experience, the plug, related. All of a sudden the child starts developing a respect for that plug, not a fear of it. It's powerful, it can do all sorts of wonderful things, it can turn lights on. A match can also turn lights on. And a match can hurt, and the plug can also hurt. Fine, I know what it is. It's powerful, it's strong, it's dangerous. Therefore I keep away from it. That's converting pachad to yira. And that's the mitzvah lo sa'aseh. We start keeping away from things because we start understanding how powerful they are and consequently how dangerous they are. One begins to understand that eating is not just a little thing that one does in a routine way. Eating is a human activity of great spiritual power. And therefore it has certain restrictions, and one appreciates that, and then one doesn't eat. But then one's not eating becomes a positive thing, not a negative thing. It becomes a yiro, not pachad. One begins to understand what Shabbos is. One begins to understand the power and the dynamicism, the potential achievements through Shabbos, what one can reach and how high one can go through a Shabbos. And then one stops doing the malachas on Shabbos. That's not out of fear. That's out of appreciation. That's out of awe. That's out of greatness. And that way one can come to keeping away from all the many things we're not allowed to do without getting sick in the process. But it's slow. That can't be done quickly. There's a period of pachad, possibly, but one has to grow out of that pachad quickly through yira, through understanding what it's all about. My concern goes one step further, and that is, number one, the proportion of negative to positive. That's one thing. Number two, let's look at the positive. So you say to the person, you must daven. So there's a period of battling during which time he learns how to daven. And it's hard, and he breaks his teeth over the words, and he works, and he works, and he works. And after a couple of years of regular davening, he's got it fluent. And then he knows how to daven. And he davens something like this. When he used to battle, there was spiritual fulfillment in his davening, because each time he davened, he felt more achievement than yesterday. One day he would be saying, Boruch She'omar, and the next day he could say, Boruch She'omar, and he would feel that he's gone further today than he went yesterday. That's fantastic. And then when he makes it to the level of having been able to daven, he's lost it altogether. Finished, gone. What kind of spiritual fulfillment can there be in mumbling through the siddur? I don't know how people do it. It must be the most boring, horrible thing. There can be no spiritual fulfillment. Come Shabbos at last, he's had a day of being involved in the material world, come Shabbos. He's going to get back to his spirituality. So he goes to shul and he davens like we've just talked. And even where there's singing parts, it becomes a routine. You sing, he sings through the whole thing like you sing every single week. He doesn't notice the word that he's saying. He doesn't understand the word that he's saying. But the tune is right and off he goes, and he gets through a couple of Shabbos, and he has a bit of a drosha, and he examines Ma'ariv, and off he goes home. Takes the wine in his hand, and drinks the wine, sits down to the meal. Where's the spirituality? What kind of fulfillment can there be in it? There can't possibly be any fulfillment in it. And what does he speak about at the Shabbos table? The same thing as he spoke about at the Thursday night table. Maybe he tries and puts a little bit of Torah into it. Shabbos morning is a repetition of the whole thing, and after lunch he goes to Shlof, and after the Shlof he gets up to come to Dan and Mincha, and that's his Shabbos. And then he goes on with Sunday. So not only are there very few positive actions now in our newfound Yiddishkeit, not only is it a religion void of positive actions, filled with negative actions, but those positive actions that there are boring routines. And those negative precepts that there are irritations. So the Yiddishkeit becomes irritable. There's no fulfillment in the positive things, there's irritation in the negative things. So where's the fulfillment going to come from? It has to come from terrorism. You've got to start terrifying yourself into all sorts of horrible imaginations about how the Ribbono Shel Olam is going to strike you down dead the next minute if you don't do it. Because you're asking, why do you do this? Tell me, what do you do? Every morning you go over the same kind of nonsense without understanding a word, without feeling anything, without any spirituality, nothing. Over and over again. Why? The Ribbono Shel Olam says, I must. What does that mean? If I don't, I won't get my Olam Haba, you know. If I don't, something terrible might happen to me, you know. That's what it really means. I'm doing it because he said I must do it. That's fear. That's pachad. That's not a hero. That's not emor. That's plain and simple being scared for my life. That's inward. There's nothing outward. There's nothing spiritual. It's the barbed wire. I'm scared for myself. That's why I do it. There's a lovely Yerushalmi in the 8th Perek of Brochus Halacha Hay, the 5th Halacha, where the Yerushalmi says the following, and here you'll see how I started on this whole rambling. I started because of the Sedra by Aloy Sechor, where the Sedra talks about light, and we talked a little bit last night about the meaning of the light. I was just trying to work out what is this light and darkness business that plays such an important part in Torah. Rabbi Levi b'shem Rabbi Bezerah. Rabbi Levi said in the name of Rabbi Bezerah, Shloishim v'shesh shos Shimsha oisah ha'oira shenivres b'yom harishon. For 36 hours after the creation of the first man, that light which God created on the first day existed. Don't forget, the light He created on the first day is not the kind of light we have today, because the sun didn't exist on the first day when He created it. It was some other kind of light. Shtei mesrei b'erev Shabbos, 12 hours on Friday, the Shtei Mesrei Belel Shabbos, and 12 hours on Friday night. So that first Friday night for Odom HaRishon, there was no night, it was light the whole time. The Shtei Mesrei B'Shabbos, and 12 itself. So just imagine, Odom HaRishon is born on Friday, and there's this brilliant light. Erev Shabbos, it's light. Shabbos during the day, it's light. The Hoyo Odom HaRishon Mabit Boi Misoif HaOilom Vad Soif. And Odom HaRishon could look with this light from one end of the world to the other. In other words, this perception. He's able to see with this right to the essence of the whole world, what it's all about. As long as the light didn't go off, the whole world started singing. There was a beautiful song that the world was involved in. Kivan sheyotza Shabbos, after Shabbos went out, hitchil meshamesh hachoshech uvot, darkness started creeping over. This must have been a terrifying experience for Odom HaRishon. He started losing his perception. He started losing his clarity. Not only couldn't he understand things intellectually as well as he was able over the last 36 hours, he can't even see things properly anymore. Then he siyarei Odom v'omar, and Odom became scared, and he said, Eilu shekosov boy, this is what about which it is written, and this is what's difficult to understand in the Yerushalmi. Hu yeshuv choroish v'ata teshufenu akev. It's written as a curse for the snake. Firstly, it's written further on, but still. He will strike your head, and you, the snake, will bite his ankle. Shema bala nashcheni. Now he's coming to bite me. Odom HaRishon was the most intelligent man that ever lived. We've never had an intellect like Odom HaRishon. What is business that starts getting dark and he starts getting scared? And of who? Of the nachash, of the snake. Amar Rabbi Levi said, Rabbi Levi,
At that moment, the Ribbono Shel Olam showed him two pieces of wood, and he struck them against each other. The Yotzei Mehen Ha'oir. And that was the first time that man-made light was created. Hadal Dichtiv V'Layla Oir Ba'adani, etc. Uvirech Aleo Borei Me'oir Ha'ish. And Adam HaRishon was so thrilled, he said, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Ha'olam Borei Me'oir Ha'ish. Shmuel Omar Lefichach Mevarchim Ala Ish B'Motzei Shabbos.
Shmuel says, that's the reason we say on Motzei Shabbos, Borei Me'oir Ha'ish, because Motzei Shabbos is the anniversary of the creation of man-made light, man-made energy. An incredible little piece of Gemara. But what we see from here is the relationship between light and clarity. The light was so great, we're told, that he could perceive the very essence of the whole world. And more so, when the clarity started deteriorating, when darkness started coming in, what is he afraid of? Aveira. The Nachash is the Satan. That's what he's afraid of, is Aveira. Getting things wrong, making a mistake. Until he was able to light the light again. And at least see things as they really were. And here we see the essence of the whole thing. Lack of clarity is the biggest enemy of spiritual progress. Now you can dress up the lack of spiritual progress in whatever dresses you want it. And you can mask it in whatever masks you want it. And you can get yourself drunk, and you can make yourself happy. And you can do all sorts of funny things to make yourself feel spiritually alive. You can terrorize yourself and terrify yourself. You can do what you like. You can cause the adrenaline to go up and you can cause the adrenaline to go down. But the enemy of progress is darkness. Just a lack of light, a lack of clarity. That's all it is. Because once you see something clearly, A, the pachad goes, the fear goes, and B, the yiro comes in. The awareness, the perception, the awe comes in. And one begins to feel the importance of what one's doing. Torah is not a list of do's and don'ts, we've said this many hundreds of times. Torah is simply a revelation of what things really are. And not an imposition, not a dogmatic revelation. This is what it is. Now just take it or leave it. Study it yourself. Let's analyze together. That's what the Torah is. Let's take whatever concept you want, because there is no concept in the world that does not find its place in halacha. Let's take whatever concept you want and let's analyze it into its components. Let's see what it's really made of. And once you know what it's really made of, you will yourself know how to react to it and how to respond to it. And naturally then you'll do it right. Once you know what you're dealing with, you'll do it right. But the ultimate is simply to understand that we need to know what we're dealing with. Certainly there is a period, particularly when one comes into Yiddishkeit later, but even not then, for everybody, there is a period where you need pachad. There's no way that you can quickly in one day try and understand the whole Torah. And understand why you can't eat a tray for steak, and why you can't put on the lights on Shabbos, and why a Kohen Gadol had to do something or other, and why, etc., etc., you can't mix milk and meat, and why you can't have chutneys, and so on and so forth. There's always going to be a need for a little bit of pachat, or even one can really call it yiro. Because the way it will work is, look, what I've studied of the Torah so far is so fascinating and so great, but the parts I don't understand, I assume, are equally great. I'll get to it soon, but meanwhile I accept it. Meanwhile I have to operate on the basis of it being great. Not pachad, not fear, but yiro. But at least there has to be a movement away from primitive fear to bolstering up one's positive reinforcement of a feeling of spirituality. One has to feel one's spirituality. One has to feel one's Yiddishkeit. In one's learning and through one's learning. In one's mitzvahs and through one's mitzvahs. Both the mitzvahs I say, both the positive mitzvahs and the negative mitzvahs. And not to get into a routine where these mitzvahs and these avodas become things that one just gets into the habit of doing and not doing, where they can't possibly lead to any kind of spiritual fulfillment, and the consequence of that must be pachad, must be fear. The Ribbono Shel Olam is not here to knock us down. He's not here to trick us. He's not here to try and get rid of us. He's here just to enable us to achieve greatness, to enable us to exercise our potential, to enable us to achieve that potential. As long as we're doing our bit and we're trying our hardest, he's on our side. He's helping us. And where you've got the Ribbono Shel Olam's will and your efforts, there's no such thing as I can't. There's nothing that can stand in the way of your effort and the Ribbono Shel Olam's consent. If you're not being successful, it's either because you're not putting in enough effort, or because you're doing the wrong thing. The Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't want you to be doing that altogether. But if you're doing the right thing, the Ribbono Shel Olam is with you, and you're putting in the effort, you're going to win. There's just no two ways about it. And we're here to win. We're here to make a success of things. We're here to have fun. We're here to climb. We're here to take on a challenge and to develop and to feel the growth, to be able to look back at the end of a day and feel I've come further than I was yesterday, and I mean it on a day-to-day basis. One should be able to do that. Something I did today which I wouldn't have done yesterday, or something I didn't do today which I would have done yesterday. And I didn't do it today not because I was terrified, but I didn't do it today because of my increased understanding of reality. That's why I didn't do it today. So one feels a slow growth, a slow development. And that's the real spiritual feeling which nothing can replace. No fake can replace the genuineness and the depth of feeling that one feels when one really grows, when one simply goes from A to B. And the method of doing it is simply to turn on the light. That's really the sum total of my rambling this afternoon. It started from Baal Osechor to this Yerushalmi. The role of clarity and the consequence of obscurity. Where one isn't clear, one immediately jumps into mystery, mysticism, terror, fear, all sorts of things which justify lack of clarity. And you say to somebody, you ask him a question, he says, no, that's mysticism, it's mystical. But what he's really saying is you don't need to understand that clearly, it's mystical. It doesn't need to be clearly understood. That's what it really means. When you're afraid of something, when there's terror, I'm doing it because the Ribbono Shel Olam will hit me if I don't. That means I don't have to understand what I'm doing. I just need to do it, otherwise he's going to hit me. These are the substitutes for understanding. When you've given up trying to understand, you start finding all these other substitutes which enable you to carry on being religious without having to understand what you're doing. One must drive towards an understanding. One must worry if one doesn't understand. I don't say you'll understand everything, but it must bother you. If there's a Rashi you don't understand, a Mitzvah you can't understand, a Gemara you don't understand, a Rambam you don't understand, that should be at the back of your mind constantly worrying you. When will you be able to understand it? When are you going to be able to conceive it? Not just so you don't understand, it doesn't matter. It does matter. Because clarity is the lifeblood of Torah progress. And that's the Baal Osechor, that's the turning on the lights as we discussed last night. The Ribbono Shel Olam does a lot for us, but at least we must have the lights on. To try and achieve this kind of clarity with the lights off, that can't work. We're not going to get into that now, but that's this whole romanticism business, which is also a way of making things look unclear so that you don't see how bad they are. That's really what it is. That's not Torah. Torah is examine what it really is and face up to it. There's a place for romance as well, but not in the base of Midrash. Thank you, ladies.